The question was asked, when the Jews had miracles in the desert, were they like the signs that people see today in their lives? And if they were different, then how were people able to go and serve a golden calf if the signs were so obvious in the time of the desert? They were miracles. So let's go with the simple understanding, which is that they were miracles. The sea split. God spoke to them at Sinai. And yet, a few days later, they're worshiping a golden calf. What's going on here? So, Chazal give us multiple angles, but they all revolve around the same idea, which is that they did not deny the existence of Hashem. If you look closely at the wording by the golden calf, they said, we're looking for a force to lead us. They said to Aaron, right, we want you to establish a force that will lead us because we're missing Moshe. They didn't say we're missing God. They said we're missing Moshe. If Moshe's gone, we need a force to lead us. So the general direction we see from Chazal, and again, there are nuances, there are slight differences, be it the Medrash that says that they were trying to connect to the forces up above, be it the Medrash that says they knew that the force that takes control of barren places is the force represented by the heavenly chariots in the vision of Ezekiel as the calf or the ox. Be it the opinion that says that when they saw God at the splitting of the sea, so it says they saw angels surrounding him, and the angels are described again in the prophecy of Ezekiel, in the prophecy of Isaiah, as having feet of calves. So the closest thing they saw to God was something that had something connected to a calf. Be it the Medrash that says that they had silver jewelry, that gold jewelry that had God's name on one side and the calf on the other, the calf that had taken out of Egypt. But the Midrashim, whichever way you're going to go, the Ramban about the force of barren places, the Pirkei Rabbeinu, the Medrash about the calf feet that they saw in the angels in the splitting of the sea, the Medrash, I think Tanhuma, that they had they had gold pieces with both engravings. But you see that all Midrashim, as far as I know, that's what I was trying to remember before I answered you. As far as I can remember, the Midrashim at large and the Rishonim at large take this angle. I don't remember a dissenting opinion, that the serving of the golden calf was not to the exclusion of Hashem. Meaning there's Hashem, fine, but he's out there, and we need a force that's down here. We need something that's ever present. So Hashem says, no, you can't have lo ta'aseh elokim acherim al panai. Don't worship any other force. There are forces in the world. Don't worship them. That's the big question. We had one or two classes on the Ran about the Ran discusses, why can't you use all these forces to cure people? We use medicine, so why can't we use demons? So long as I don't worship them, if these forces are forces in nature, let me tap into them. Let me use them. Why is that prohibited? Why can't I talk to the dead? Why is there biblical prohibition asking the dead for the future? It's a force that exists in nature, so let's use it. What's wrong? I'm not praying to it. So at any rate, coming back here, the general direction we see is that there's always that desire to have something more ready. I would even say more controllable, but maybe that's already my interpretation. But humanity wants something more accessible, and God is very difficult to access. So you don't control God. You make yourself your idol, so you have more control. And that brings us to a whole other discussion. That's the whole idea of Naaman, the chief general of the Arameans, who was a leper. And he comes out with all his troops to the prophet Elisha. You know the story I'm talking about. So he was a leper, and he heard of all the miracles that Elisha did. So he comes down to Elisha, and he wants Elisha to cure him. First, he sends word to the king of Israel, and he says, cure my top general, and the king starts weeping. He says, obviously they want war. They're asking for something I can't give them. And Elisha sends him a message and says, what are you so worried about? Send him to me. There's a prophet in Israel. So Naaman comes with all his battalion, and he's standing out there in full arms outside Elisha's house. So Elisha sends out a kid, and he says, go tell the general to go to the waters of the Jordanian River, bathe in them, and he'll be cured. So here Naaman is standing with all his army and everything, and a kid comes out and says, the prophet said to tell you, go to the Jordan. So Naaman throws a fit. He said, I thought he'd come out here with his magic wand. I thought he'd go waving. I thought he'd do something. We have much better ponds out in where I come from. What's he doing? This is how you treat a chief general like me. And he's very upset. And one of his officers says, you know what? You came this far. He is a prophet. Listen to him. What you got to lose? Go dunk in the Jordanian River. So he goes to the Jordan and he dunks. And his skin becomes like a baby's skin. He's completely cured. Suddenly you see a totally different story. He comes into Elisha. He doesn't stand out there waiting in pomp and glory, let Elisha come to me. He comes in. He bows. He's respectful. He says, wow, now I realize there's a God in Israel. Wow, okay. What can I pay you? Elisha says, nothing. But, no, I don't want anything. Naaman travels, and Elisha's servant Gehazi liked money, so he goes chasing after Naaman, and he says, what's wrong with my master? See, you are the chief general, you could have so much money, what's going on? I'm going to take care of him. He comes after him and he says, Elisha sent me. You know, the rabbi sent me. That's always, the rabbis get in trouble that way. The rabbi sent me to tell you that. We just had a bunch of paupers show up, and our young students really need a help. Maybe you could give a donation. We'll give it to them. And so he gives the money, and Gehazi takes all the money and clothing and everything he gave him. And as he's coming back, Elisha says, "May I, Gehazi? Where are you coming from, Gehazi? He hasn't yet set foot into the tent." And Elisha calls him and says, "May I, where are you coming from?" So Gehazi thinks he's going to get away with it. He's like, well, Elisha says, interesting. Why did Naaman turn around? I didn't go with you, nor did my spirit go with you. And you will have the leprosy of Gehazi for you and your children. It will stick to you for generations. And Elisha finishes talking, and Gehazi is white as snow, and him and his three children are kicked out of the camp, and they're lepers for life. One of the conflicts that was ongoing there was the desire of Naaman to give you something. Let me control you. I know you're a prophet, but that's why I came with all my valor. I came here. I'm the boss. So Elisha purposely sends him out, a little kid. Go tell him. So now, why does leprosy come? Why does tzaras come? Because the person's way too haughty. So now Elisha has to go, Gehazi goes and dunks in the stinky river. The Jordanian River used to have a lot of the garbage from all the other rivers would build up in the Jordanian River. So he's going out there and he's not too pleased dunking in this river. But suddenly he sees, hey, wait a second. I'm not what I thought I was. And the river's not what I thought it was. And the man isn't what I thought he was. But let me give him money. That desire to control God. And that's what Gehazi ruined by running after him and saying, give me the money. So the people know there's a God in heaven, but we don't control him. And we don't know how to forecast him. We don't understand him. We have a limited scope. And then there's a much broader area where we don't understand. And we're still going to learn tonight. We said yesterday we'd learn the Medrash Tanhuma, the beautiful Medrash Tanhuma at the end of Parshas Vayera that discusses what happened at that Akedah. Very long Medrash Tanhuma, probably one of the longest, but one of the most beautiful on Bereishis. And what part of what we're going to see is how Avram and Sarah and Yitzchak, they didn't have this handle on, I know God, I know where he's headed. So there's always that desire, even if you'll have all the miracles in the world, where God's giving you money every day, but you don't control him. There's no way to tell him what to do. And one of the reasons that people are always looking for amulets is because they figure, then I control God. If I did this, I got it. That's it. It's going to work. And it doesn't work that way. But that's one of the desires that people have. So when Moshe disappears from the scene, the people say, let's make us a god. They're not saying to the exclusion of God. They're saying, let's make something more controllable. So that's the general direction we see. That the people were not denying God in desiring the golden calf. It was together with the understanding that God is there. But we can still set things up. There are still forces in the world we can tap into. There are still other ways to do this. So the people are willing to do Baal Peor. And this idea is spelled out in the Malbim, in the book of Shoftim, in the book of Judges. That how come the people are becoming pagans? They see all these miracles. How come they're doing that? So the Malbim says it wasn't to the denial of God. It was, let's have something else with it. So all the miracles that they saw gave them an understanding that God's up in heaven, but he's still very distant. All our discussion until now was focused on that angle without the Rambam and Ralbag. With the question of Bechira Chofshit and the capacity to deny. That deserves a separate discussion. What would the Rambam do with the man? Which the Rambam himself says, that's the great sign that God was leading them in the desert. That's like the undeniable sign for 40 years, they have food falling from heaven for 2 million people. So that's why I'm leaving that out. I prefer going the other route for
so
now.
So what do they do with it in terms of the
Rambam? So I'm saying, if God isn't active here, you see that Adam knew God created the world, right? And yet he could eat from the forbidden fruit. How? Because he could start telling God, maybe you don't really know what's going on here because you're asking me, where am I? So there's that idea of God saying, Ayeka, God not showing us in our face, I know exactly what's going on in your heart and I know exactly what's going on. And that's the misleading part of even the believer. Adam, Cain, Bilam. All make the same mistake. They get that false impression. He's not really on top of things. Job.
How do you get like the 80% according to Midrash that didn't even leave Egypt after seeing these so many miracles? You know, I mean, to me, it's kind of mind-boggling. In, you know, the standard thing I was told, that, you know, the gates of horror were stronger. They, you know, it seems incredible, but that's what the Medrash says, right? And, you know, so miracles seem to be... Yeah, I could see if you live in the desert even, you know, you're getting the man, which you say is the greatest miracle. You got used to it, you know, it's you arrive 40 years later and cannot, hey, where's my breakfast? You know, you don't think of it like, you know, it's a miracle anymore. And the idea that, I guess, you're in Egypt, you're not a slave anymore, right, after the first plague, and that, okay, yeah, we're supposed to go out, but it's still mind-boggling. It doesn't seem to have any effect on behavior in many ways. Strange,
huh? I want to just say something. It's going to get on Tzion's nerves a little bit, but that's not my intent. Just something we should notice. You know, I kept asking myself, should I say it? Shouldn't I say it? But I think there is something we have to think about a little bit today. When there was the Iraqi war, so I have a book describing all the scuds of the Gulf War. All the scuds falling here and what happened here. You know that 2 hours ago, a missile was heading to Tel Aviv. You guys are unaware of that. A missile fell in Rishon LeZion. And another missile fell in the river in Tel Aviv.
Really? Today?
Right. Today, 2 hours ago.
In the river?
Yeah.
Wow.
In the, I guess it's in the Mediterranean. I'm not sure where. They said it fell in the water. In Bat Yam, yeah. Right. I'm just saying, you know, we're living here in the 15 minutes I was headed from Kiryat Moshe to Katamon this morning, I heard a report of between 8 and 10 missiles. 15 minutes. The number of missiles that are being fired at us, like, mind-boggling. And you think, what are these missiles? So I didn't check this out, but someone pointed out to me that these are missiles that the Germans used to conquer some of the countries in Europe they were conquering. These are missiles that did tremendous damage in world history. They're missiles that can inflict tremendous harm. The Grad missile. I'm just saying we're living at a time now as we speak. You're talking about what happened then. Let's think about what's happening now. I'm just saying it's a...
People are all running to the shootings that were running before, in other words.
No, I'm saying, we have to appreciate something's going on here. I think in the last 2 days, they said in the news, I don't remember, did you see the number? How many hundreds of missiles were shot at us?
200.
I saw a number 150. But that doesn't make sense to me, because I'm telling you, in the 15 minutes I was on the bus this morning, I heard the live Tzeva Adom from Be'er Sheva, from Gedera, from Kiryat Malachi, from as they were on the news, they'd announce, right now there's a missile headed to Be'er Sheva. Please go down to the Miklatim. I'm hearing this on the news. I heard it 10 times in 15 minutes. I don't think it could be only 150 today. I don't know the number. When I looked, they were talking about 150. So, and the three casualties we have, which is a huge number, but the three casualties we have were three people who decided to sit on the porch and watch the missiles fall, with all due respect to them. I feel bad for them, but there are certain things that you're not supposed to do. Fine.
They were sitting there on the porch?
That's what the news says, that they were sitting outside watching. Right, it is terrible. I think they were also visiting. I don't think they were Israelis. They might not have known what they're supposed to do.
If you're not Israeli, you should run like the wind. I mean, if you hear missiles, you don't know if you've ever been here.
Nah, I would probably sit on the porch alone.
I'm in a country where all I hear about on the news is wars and stuff.
I'm just saying, before we look back, let's look now. We are living at a special time. We have no guarantees about what's going to be tonight or tomorrow. We have to daven, and Bezat Shem, we should hear only good news. But at the end of the day, I'm saying 150 missiles. Let's go by the small number. And only one missile made casualties. Okay, I think there's a lot to be thankful for, And I don't see anyone, when I walked into yeshiva this morning, so the guys were talking about going out to a protest. I said, protest? If people are being shot at, go daven. You don't want to learn daven, but a protest, what's that all about? I don't see us waking up, so we look back at them and say, so they saw things extraordinary. So the truth is that man is a miracle. And this, you can argue. You can argue. Statistically, I'm not sure how much you can argue. Statistically, I don't know the statistics. I don't know the facts on the ground. But this, I don't think you could say is like what they had in the desert. The way the Torah describes it, those were things that there was no way to explain. There was no way to explain the man traveling wherever they traveled, enough food for 2 million people falling from heaven. There's no way to explain that. So that's miraculous. What we're seeing today is, you could call it a miracle, you could call it the hand of God. Yesterday or 2 days ago, I was in a taxi, and the taxi driver told me they interviewed on the news one of the members of Hamas, and they asked him, how come you guys keep missing with your missiles? So the member said, we're not missing. God's on their side. He said, we know what we're doing. This isn't the way it's supposed to be playing itself out.
When did this happen today?
I don't know when it happened. The taxi driver quoted this to me. He said to me, we aim and it doesn't land there. What?
You're saying the last 2 days?
A taxi driver told me this. 2 days ago, I was sitting in a taxi and he told me, what do you say about this Obama? I said, we're in trouble. He said, we're not in trouble. If he's there, it must be good for us. I was like, okay, I'm not going to argue with you. And then he quoted me this interview. He said, don't you see things are not just happening? There's a guiding hand here. Okay, I got my Musa lesson from the morning from a taxi driver. Okay.
The guy who said the Hamas leader who said God's on their side is probably
He's probably grounds for death.
He okay.
You know what I'm saying?
You say that, it's like,
Yeah, I get your point. I
should look at how harmful people can get away with.
Yeah.
But I don't think he meant, I don't know if he worded it like their God is protecting them, or, you know, he must have worded it politically correct. I don't know.
Be a home bear coming to our side too.
Yeah, David, what?
I just wanted to continue on that fence. So we would say then the times of the desert generation, miracles of Egypt, we have to look at that as exceptional circumstances.
We see that. Now, in the days of the prophets, so that's the Maimonides we didn't get to discuss. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather learn it inside, that we don't believe based on miracles. Miracles, like Maimonides writes, any miracle you witness will leave doubts. And that's what Maimonides writes. Moshe Rabbeinu said to God, I do not want to be a part of this if the people will believe in me because of miracles. Maimonides says that was the beginning of Moshe's journey. When God asked him to be an emissary, Moshe said, what am I going to do? So God said, here's this sign, that sign, and the other sign. And Moshe said, well, if they're going to believe based on miracles, then at the end of the day, they're also going to doubt. You can't see a miracle and then walk away and not ask yourself, did he jinx me? Is something there? Did I miss something? So you can't, you're never going to be fully confident when you witness a miracle. Now Maimonides is talking about a situation where it's a miracle. Water turns to blood. The snake turns to staff. The hand becomes a leper. And then it turns into the hand again. And even so, Maimonides says, Moshe Rabbeinu said to God, I don't want to be the emissary if they're going to believe in me based on miracles. It shows us how much of a skeptic Moshe wanted us to be. And so God gave him a promise. No, it won't be based on miracles. They're going to have clarity that's going to be beyond that. And then Moshe agreed.
That's the guy?
No, that's in the Rambam in Yesodei Torah. Rambam in Halacha, not Mor Nebuchim. Yeah. On this point?
Yeah.
So we're good? But
so,
I think David's first. Sorry, Jose.
Yeah. When we're speaking on miracles, I see you keep on saying, like, you know, I'm not going to quote it a miracle. Like, you're kind of a lot of times avoid saying it's a miracle or making the call that it's a miracle. And I'm wondering, could you come into problems by concluding things are miracles? Like, if I see someone almost got run over by a car, I'm saying, well, it's a miracle. Is there something wrong with that? Like,
I think if we want to understand that, then I'll borrow from the Rambam's son's letter. The Rambam's son wrote a letter about those who fight for the Talmud. He says, sometimes the Talmud will say a line about medicine or nature, and people will say, if the rabbis of the Talmud said it, it must be that way, and they'll fight for it, and they'll put everything they have on that horse, figuratively. And then when they'll be disproven, so then they lost everything. Because then they'll say, okay, so everything's a lie. So he says, I much rather you say that when it comes to nature, they said the way they understood. And if they were wrong, so they were wrong. That's not tradition, you know. So their comments on nature, or their comments on how things work in nature, so fine. So they said lightning comes from two clouds crashing. Okay. So if they'll be proven wrong in nature, so then fine. So that doesn't contradict anything else they said. So my fear along those lines is that when a person starts making miracles of things, so then when those things are disproven, so then the splitting of the sea will also be disproven in his head. What happens is, and that's my concern, people equate stories of today or stories of the last 100 or 200 years with the Tanakh, and that's not right. I was sitting with guys who I learned with in another yeshiva, and they brought a book that tells of miracles that a certain Rebbe did. So I said, please don't leave that here when we're learning Torah. So they said, you have a problem with the book? I said, yeah. If I didn't think you'd take it the wrong way, I'd put it on the floor and not on the table. So they all got very upset. So their rabbi also got very upset. So they're all yelling at me there. And I said, okay, fine, we're not going to argue now. 5 minutes into our learning, one of them said to me, don't you understand, it's one of the principles of faith that the rabbi, that rabbi in the book, could do miracles? So I called over the rabbi. I said, come here, listen to your student now. You see the problem? You see, he's already made this a principle of faith. And if this story in this book is going to be disproven, so then the whole Torah went down the tubes too. Because he just said, you're a student, right? You're teaching him that all these miracles are so important. So then that becomes Torah. Look at how the Rambam came out against it. The Rambam said Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want us to be a religion of miracles, signs. This is a story from last week. And the students are still quoting it to me. Last week, I told them, put the book on the floor, don't leave it on the table. I told them, that book that you have right there, I was offered for free. My son and I go to a learning session where they give you prizes. So they wanted to give us that book. I told my son, it's not entering our house. I'm not bringing that home.
Is this like any other book like this? Or is this a specific book that is certain?
That's a book which I happen to have seen about a rabbi who was living in this century, and the whole book is telling you like every second he's doing another miracle. Okay, fine.
There are a few books like that, huh?
Okay, so I don't
mention this rabbi's name so we know how to avoid this book.
Okay. What difference does it make? So that's my fear. You want to call this a miracle and that a miracle, and then we become a religion of miracles, and that's not what we are. That's not what it's all about.
What I'm asking is because I see certain things in my life that I think Hashem directly helped me in the different things, and I say it's a miracle. I feel that Hashem inspires me. I'm not going to say it's me. I want to say it. So I don't understand. I'm not going to be misleading about it because I know. I mean, let's say I see someone get saved by a car crash. It's a miracle. I'm inspired. I go back home and I'm inspired now.
Fine. The Torah says we have a biblical mitzvah to pray today, right? The Torah says when bad things happen, when there's a danger to Israel, then Israel has a mitzvah to pray. And the Torah says when things start looking bad, you have a mitzvah to stop and ask yourself, why is this happening? Where should I do different? And do tshuva. So obviously, part of what the Torah wants us to do is see Hashem's hand in our lives. That's true. But then the question is, if you fumble and you drop your keys, do you say, boy, the Ribbono Shel Olam upset me today. What did I do wrong? I dropped my keys. You understand? The question is, where's the limit? I see a lot of people being very nervous and to the point of OCD, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder. What does God want from me now? I don't get it. I didn't have the right change for the bus driver. He didn't have change. I had to catch the next bus. What did I do wrong? I davened shacharis with such kavana. How come? How come I missed my bus if I downed chakras right? People, everything becomes a game. And then people think they could forecast the game. And that's not what Judaism is all about. It's not. So you want to say there's hashgacha, I don't argue with you. You want to say you see it in your life, I don't argue with you. You want to say there's a system that you can forecast and you could work with? I don't think so. We don't see that Avraham Avinu had a system that he could forecast and work with. We have 613 mitzvos. That's our system. That's what we work with. If you merit to see in your life that Hashem's hand is there for you, great. I don't contest that. That's what I said earlier. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just saying be very careful because people make big mistakes in their lives off of this. I had a guy who invested in the stock market based on signs. So the first 3 years he was very successful. But I knew him the next 3 years too. Okay. So he told me all kinds of signs. Fine. I know more than one person like that. You understand that the question is where do you draw the line? And that's why I rather draw the line further back. And the halacha says, you're not going to make decisions based on signs. Hashem wants you to do shtadlus. You're supposed to make an effort, get a job, lead a normal life. Within that life, you see God's hand. Good. You should see his hand. But be careful from thinking you understand him. Yeah.
Israel is under attack right now. And we are sitting here in Yeshiva not really taking any action in the